John Pettigrew.
So hey everyone, welcome to Julie Cornfield, who just showed up. And hello to everyone in Complex Lewis, and hello to everyone out there in Webland who's clicked in for this. The purpose of this talk is manyfold. One is that Fred and Dave couldn't think of anything else to put on for this week, and we had so many newcomers for this this new, slightly new phase. There is a kind of rationale here, is that we're in an intermediate phase between our sort of first chapter of this workshop was modulated mildly towards stiff biopolymers, as some of you may just have noticed who were here during the time. The second phase is designed similarly mildly to be modulated in favor of self-assembled, particularly surfactant systems. So the one reason, I suppose another reason why post-decision one could justify talking about peptide self-assembled polymers now is that the idea is it sort of bridges the gap between a potential system which mimics some of the things that Tony Maggs, Dave Morse, Christoph Friedrich, Ronnie Granek, Fred himself, people have been talking about. It may be a lot kinder on us than actin and DNA, who knows, but it's certainly self-assembled and shares many properties, as I hope you'll see, with some of the self-assembled surfactant systems that François Molineau and Beret and Peter Olmsted and Susan Fielding over there are going to be talking to us about, I'm sure, in the next few weeks. The third reason for talking about this is that there are conversations that I wish to have with people who are here. One of them is Dave Morse, because we want to explore whether, and Fred, whether this might be a nice experimental example for a case study to check some of these nice and beautiful results on stiff polymers. Another is Victor over there, who's similarly used rheology as a probe to tease out some of the molecular parameters in a related system. I'll be telling you about a similar story to the rheological story that Christoph Friedrich told us a couple of weeks ago. And another is I want to talk with Carlos Marx over there about some of the slow kinetics. There are many names here because it's a very interdisciplinary project. I'm going to be talking about some theory, some experiments, a little bit of biochemistry, some light scattering, and these are always big teams. So Sheena Radford helped with the synthesis side, extracting the particular peptides we designed. Amalia Ageli at the SOMS Centre and Neville Bowden and his team really were at the inception of this project many years ago. Sasha Semyonov and Irina Nikova, as well as being happily married, are also happily involved in this project. That's me and this team at Heracleion, many of you will know. So what we're going to be, we're asking questions about self-assembled peptides. That's just a cartoon. Don't worry if you don't know what a peptide is, nor did I at the beginning of this story. In fact, it's the beginning of this project is my favorite story when I give talks to the schools or whatever about how science really works and how all of us have to not mind being ignorant, because when Neville Bowden actually first came to me in Leeds at the senior common room one day and said, Tom, I'd like you to help us with these peptide gels we've got, I had that sort of momentary decision that went the wrong way. You know when someone uses a word that you don't understand in science and you're already a famous professor or something, and so whoever you are, and you say, like, peptide. And I thought, what's peptide? I mean, I didn't do biology at school, and it sounded like something very complicated and biological that I would never understand. Of course, it turns out that it is something complicated and biological which I will never understand, but that it doesn't mean that it's difficult in the first instance. So it was several weeks before I went back and said, actually, before we talk about this project, you have to tell me what a peptide is. And he told me it was a little bit of protein, and a protein was a molecule, etc. So that's right. So we're going to be asking why and when they self-assemble. We're going to be addressing what's a good coarse-grained soft matter physicist's approach to this apparently horrendously local, specific biological system of little pieces of protein that have, there are hydrogen bonds, electrostatic interactions, hydrophobic groups, how goodness knows, 20 plus amino acids all interacting in different ways. Is this really something a physicist even wants to have nightmares about. We're going to find their bundling, we're going to find a whole hierarchy of self-assembled structures that will appear, and each one will dominate at different concentrations. So we're going to ask why it is that when something starts to assemble, why it should never stop. One of the fascinating things about self-assembled structures in biology, including DNA bundles, is why they ever stop bundling, or why don't they just drop out of solution? And there's an interesting story to tell there. I don't think this morning we'll get on to slow kinetics, but I hope... Sorry?
Slow kinetics takes more time.
There's no time to do slow kinetics. In fact, you will find that some of the really interesting kinetic problems in self-assembly we're going to touch on have time scales of months and years in these vector systems. That's why we're not going to have time to do it before half past 11. It says a lot about amateurs of experimental skills. Some of these people, they just leave things on a shelf for 6 months. It's worth doing, making sure that they sample those sorts of timescales. And we're going to ask, okay, do they constitute an example of highly entangled stiff polymers? The other thing we're going to ask is there perhaps a direct biological application? This may well underpin some of the processes going on in amyloid diseases like Alzheimer's. And I'd like to be able to solve Alzheimer's before it's too late for me. And there are other things there. Right. So the story. Once upon a time, Neil Bowden and Amelia were extracting a peptide from a protein that's an ion channel protein. It makes potassium ion channels in cell membranes. And they were extracting this particular protein, which has 27 residues, but as you probably know if you've been in this business, there's a solid thing called a solid state synthesizer that makes peptides. It often goes wrong. And one of the ways it can go wrong is to miss out, to just lop some peptides off the end and makes a slightly different sequence of mini proteins. So this is the one it made. Instead of making the full 27 residue amino acid little chain, it made this one with 24 in only, lysine, leucine, and so on. Some of the other ones, I've just got charges here to indicate there's a little couple of charges. There must be another negative charge somewhere on this one. There are three conjugated rings on this side, coming from, there's a tryptophan somewhere, tyrosine here, I'm not quite sure where they are, but here they are. And at any rate, so you purify this in solution and so forth, except not this time you don't, because this happened. This is roughly 1% solution of this stuff in 2-chloroethanol was the organic solvent they were using to purify the peptide, and the thing just formed a gel. Now, this isn't as uncommon as all that. These things often happen. What was uncommon in this situation is rather than throw the stuff away, these guys decided it was worth studying, because gels at 1% indicate something interesting has happened. And that is, this picture is the right way up.
How quickly does this happen?
This is just like that, yeah.
And is that in water, is that in...
That's in 2-chloroethanol in this case. Okay. So I skipped some years here. And so that'll be our first peptide, this one we've called K24, K because it was from a potassium channel, 24 because it only has 24 residues. Over the next couple of years, we clearly wanted to identify aqueous systems that would do the same, and it turns out not to be all that difficult to do. So Sheena Radford and Amelia designed a couple of rather shorter, I think they're 11 residue peptides, that by virtue of a simple model had in our mind of what they were doing, and you'll gather in a little while, we think they were doing is just lying end to end and building hydrogen bond and hydrophobic interactions that would naturally predispose the peptides to form these elongated beta sheet structures. They designed these two, it's a little family of two peptides, which have sufficient hydrophilic side groups, moieties to exist happily in solution, but also sufficient hydrophobic and hydrogen bonding donor receptor capabilities to bond to each other. They're now called P11-1 and P11-2, but in some papers it's confusing. This one was designed first and is sometimes called DN1, but they only differ in three residues, two phenols and a tryptophan in this guy, which provides these conjugated rings off one side. So the idea is one of these is specially hydrophobic in the sense of conjugated rings along one side, and the other one isn't. It just has... Did I not change it? Oh, you're right. I didn't. No, this has... Okay, so... This... Okay, we're... These just have glycines. Okay, so you're absolutely right. So PM1, thank you. Last minute, I failed to complete the job here. Yes, I copied and pasted without actually changing the residues. I'm sorry, these just have glycines. You're right, I didn't do it. Well spotted. See if you're still paying attention in an hour's time. So these must have formed polymers. Why must there be polymers in there? It must be polymers, because if you only have 1%, and these gels can form at 0.1%, you have 0.1% volume-filling, interesting material. The rest is solvent. But the whole thing is solid to gel. Solidity, rheological solidity, is seen. Well, no, it's all about connectivity. Something is solid if bits of the space inside the volume are connected by robust links. And so if you've only got 0.1% or 1% material, you have to do that one-dimensionally. Possibly you could do it with sheets, but it's much more likely. There must be one-dimensional structures in there. Now, this is such a compelling argument. We felt that really all we need to do to publish this interesting result in Nature was to do the rheology. We learned was that... the power of this argument is not universally appreciated. So we did some microscopy as well. So here are some pictures. This is K24. These are very diluted systems evaporated onto grid. So you super dilute, put a little drop on, evaporate what you've got down onto a grid, and you say there are one-dimensional structures there. This one's pretty clear. Actually, it's much better. Here, the resolution of this projector has really interfered, interestingly, with this photograph, which is a shame. But I hope you can see the one-dimensional structures in PN. Oh, I'm sorry, I failed to edit this. That is P22. This guy okay, I should have done it the last one. It's P21. Okay. Rather different morphologies, and this is K24 again. So this is the non-aqueous system. So you can see that these two fellows have persistence lengths of the order of a few hundred nanometers. That's what this is.
This is
TEM, yes. So there, this is not cryo-cut, this is evaporated down to the grid.
So it's quite dangerous to get...
Of course. Yes, absolutely right, yeah. They're being sheared like crazy, and they're self-assembled anyway. And we know that self-assembly is a big function. This is why we far prefer the rheological arguments. But if the editors of Nature insist on using an unreliable and misleading, and are happy with this, then we'll do it. Okay, well, no, it's a little bit cynical, but so we're going to be looking at other methods to extract these numbers. Fear not. But the lesson is you have to do the TEM, or people like to see the pretty pictures. So so what's going on here? Can we motivate a physicist's first order coarse grained model? Okay, here's the first aid model of that little peptide. It's a mini piece of protein, which can be quite linear, especially when it self-assembles, and it's got hands outside, a little ring of people like that with hands, and those are the hydrogen bonds, and they like holding hands. So if they like holding hands, then that's what they'll presumably do. And now, each of these is a little rod. So there's little energy for them to self-assemble in this linear form, rather like surfactants tubes, but the structure locally will be like a tape. And you see, because this, or like my watch strap, you know, it could be little stiff linear objects lining up, as it were, like a fence. We've drawn the tape twisted because, like all biological molecules, these are chiral, they're handed, and so when you stack an object with handedness up, that the handedness will quite generically induce a twist, a helical twist, which will be right or left-handed onto the tape. So we expect these tapes to be linear, floppy, very floppy in one dimension. Let me just take my watch off and you can see what I mean. They'll have a floppy direction and they'll have a stiff direction. But because they're also likely to be twisted, the floppy and stiff axes will rather rapidly rotate, and so in a slightly more coarse-grained level, this will act like a flexible polymer, but it'll do that. So these may perhaps, I won't dare to suggest that we're looking at that sort of cartoon in this picture. That would be quite wrong, but...
The distinction between the last two pictures is a brief twist, or are those two alternatives?
Yes. If there's any non-zero, there's no reason why, because these two sides aren't inequivalent, there's no reason why there shouldn't be a residual curvature. There's likely to be a little residual curvature towards the white side or towards the black side as well. And when you combine that with a twist, you get a helical structure like that.
By light and dark, you're indicating hydrophobic.
Yes. So, right. So once this has happened, also the two sides are tip. Unless you force the symmetry of interaction of the two sides, it's likely that there'll be a slightly more hydrophilic side and a slightly more hydrophobic side, or in general, solventophilic and solventophobic. Okay. That immediately points us to further degrees of aggregation that we might expect. Okay, so the picture is hydrogen bonding modified by electrostatics, and here we are. So here's the end of a tape, and here's another little peptide, and it's got itself aligned and stretched out in the right combination. These hydrogen bonds are going to form. So, and this can be aided by electrostatics, which in the case of Ta24 were at the end of the peptides. And in the case of K24, the charges either end predispose an anti-parallel orientation, where in fact the thing oscillates. So you have up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. That's the case, in fact, because where you can get symmetry on both, you can follow the symmetries of the side of the tapes. Another interest expecting this is that this biological motif, the beta sheet or beta strand, is very common in biology everywhere. And it's also structural. So, example, if you go to the protein database and use your favorite protein database simulator, if Chris Wiggins were here, he would giggle at this one, because this is my favorite. This is the lac repressor, or a little piece of the lac repressor protein, which binds to DNA. And you'll see everywhere there are little pieces of the structure that I'm motivating here. 1, 2, 3, 4, I think there are 5 beta strands. And in fact, this is a very physically coherent piece, rigid piece of the protein. Embedded inside it is a little part, little hand of this beta sheet structure. There's another one. There are other ones here. So biology uses these types of peptides when they're incorporated within a protein sequence to lend structural rigidity into proteins all the time. Okay, so if you don't like TM, then one has a bit of AFM. So Alistair Smith leads. This is my favorite AFM photograph, actually, one of these. This is Casey's K24 on mica, I think. If you didn't believe it before, I hope you believe it now. Here's a single piece of tape. There's a single piece of tape with a coiled coil. This has double the height of that, and there's a little loop around the top. In fact, I've only just realized, I haven't done the sum, but actually, there are other things. This is down on the surface. It still isn't necessarily the representative of the statistics you'd see in solution. But you could use this to calculate a ratio of the persistence length and the tape adhesion. The reason, of course, that we think this likes to make regions of double tape is because there is a slightly more solventophilic side and a solventophobic side, and that energy only has to be small in order to bring two tapes together and form something we call a ribbon or a double tape, because you've got a lot of it. So the fraction of KT multiplied by hundreds and hundreds of peptides can add up to a decent energy for doing this. And presumably this has wound up and wound up and wound up until the addition of one other tape bonded pair is the same as the additional bending energy you'd have to pay for that little loop right there. So perhaps that's a calculation someone can do for homework. What else can we check with? Well, in biochemistry, two types of spectroscopy are routinely used to measure degree of secondary structure inside proteins, either alpha helices or beta sheets. Those are ultraviolet circular dichroism and Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, and there are rather generic, I'm not surprised to hear this, but there are very generic infrared frequent peaks of absorption that are indicative of helix and beta sheet structure. With this wave number 1625 is indicative of sheet, and in the alpha violet spectrum as well, there's a little peak. You can see what these are. So these are spectra at various types of solvent. So if you play with, for example, you take the K24 system and start adding methanol at a fixed temperature, rather than the 2-chloroethanol, the methanol will dispose the aggregates to deaggregate, and will tend to favor the monomeric form of the peptides. You can see with increasing methanol concentration, this little peak goes away. I think this is also happening here. Okay, so spectroscopy tells the same story. Right, let's try and put some numbers into this picture. First of all, at the level of the self-assembly. So, great, we all understand self-assembly, and one-dimensional self-assembly is an even nicer thing to study, because there's a sort of quite a well-known generic coarse-grained model for it. If you have little tiny monomeric objects that want to self-assemble and form strings, each string has an entropy translation and an energy associated with it. It's also a free energy because you can count internal degrees of freedom. And it goes like this. So you to calculate the free energy of a system, you add up over all your aggregates, and each aggregate is simply labeled by the number of monomers m in the string. So you sum over m, n log n, this is the interaction volume of an individual monomer. So this is the entropy of translation of the mth object. E is E, V is the volume, N of M, that's the number density of molecules of type M in the volume. V naught is little volume per monomer. And then you need to count an energy for each M. And really the whole game amounts to deciding what is your energy function, epsilon of M. Of your nth aggregate. You've got complete freedom there. And within this picture, within this whole domain, lie the example of one-dimensional Wernicke surfactant micelles, where the energy just comes from the end cap energy. So a string of any length will have to pay, relative to the infinite dimensional polymer, a little energy for each end it has. You could also, at least phenomenologically, motivate critical micelle concentration here. If you have some function epsilon m which favors a particular m in some rough way, you'll find the CMC emerges from the picture, and so forth. There is, of course, a constraint here, a conservation constraint on monomers. So you have to conserve monomers of sum over nm, the number density of monomers of polymers of polymerization extent m times m is the total amount of material, or total number of monomers, and that's m. We need a model for this. Perhaps a favorite example, actually the picture isn't quite right, because this is stacked, ordered worm-like micelles, but if you think of disordering these cylindrical worm-like micelles, you have the classical Cates case of worm-like micelles. The energy is, in this case, just twice the cap energy for every micelle. And a well-known statistics emerges from that, an exponential distribution of lengths. It's just, after all, a weighting process. You can walk along a polymer, and at every point you have a fixed probability of finding an end. So therefore, the molecular weight distribution is exponential. And importantly, the average degree of polymerization, M, has this behavior. It's Boltzmann weighted, of course, with the cap energy, as you'd expect, but it has this interesting behavior. When you do the, it's very trivial, half a page calculation, which you can certainly do afterwards if people want to see how it goes, of minimizing that free energy with a constraint via Lagrange multiplier, you can find that it has a square root concentration on concentration. So if you throw in monomer, pour it in, then obviously you predispose the chains to grow, but they grow as the square root of concentration. Okay. Now, this system doesn't do that. The K interval doesn't do this. You can measure, so this is the ultraviolet spectrum, you can measure the degree of beta sheet quite accurately by integrating over the peak, and you can you can plot that against the concentration of monomer. So these are results for, actually it's P11-2. It's the last of the three. It's the aqueous self-assembling peptide with those aromatic rings on one side. But they all look like this. The fraction of self-assembled peptide, and indeed the molecular weight, has this S-shaped behavior. It's not going a C to the half at the beginning. It's got a little suppressed bit, a little tail before it grows. So it's does not fall quite into the same family as the worm-like micelles. So we're going to, what Sasha and Irina did, motivated by well-known things in biochemistry, is to just modify the picture a little bit. You see, this isn't really a very good representation of the little peptide in free solution. These things do not wander around as stiff rods, waiting to join up into a nice stiff beta sheet. Yes, indeed, they have to be rather stiff when they're part of a coherent sheet. But when they're free in solution, they can exploit. They're far freer to exploit internal degrees of freedom. They might even wish to be a full-blown alpha helix, little alpha helix. But even if they don't go as far as that, they can certainly exploit other degrees of freedom. Which is a bit unlike a surfactant molecule. Or the typical surfactants that are used to make worm-like micelles don't really have so much internal restriction when they self-assemble. These have a sizable degree of restriction when they self-assemble. So,
can you go back to the experiments at that region where the radiation occurs at early?
Let's go back a page.
Small concentrations. No, that one.
Is it one more?
What's the typical molecular weight there?
Yes, that's a good question. That's a very good question. It's quite high. It's quite high. It's all when you get what Fred is quite right is saying is what's emerging here is a sort of critical concentration C star above which things happen. And the answer is, so you're interested, that C star, do I only have a few or do I have quite a lot? And actually that can depend. In fact, the answer is completely different whether I'm using P11-1 or P11-2. P11-1, C star, has much shorter chains than P11-2. I'll come back to that, but what a good question. Okay, so this is now the picture that actually the correct picture in solution is a rather wiggly version of this, which has a little bit of free energy to pay to transform itself. Obviously, it happens all at once, but you could imagine it's going to transform itself into a little stiff rod, E epsilon trans, which can then form the tape. So rather than having a one energy parameter model of one-dimensional self-assembly, the minimal model we claim for this system is a two energetic parameter self-assembly. And all this does, as you might well imagine, all this does is to shift, is to give you something which looks a little bit like a CMC. I mean, you need a sufficient concentration so that the translational entropy of these guys does not overwhelm the net energy you have to pay to self-assemble them. Okay, and that's why both the concentration of tape, why the average molecular weight doesn't really grow until a shifted concentration. Or if you like, you could think of it as I have to get to a concentration because my monomers, unlike the surfactant case, my monomers aren't just hanging around there in solution waiting to self-assemble. They're in a free energy well to start with. I'm going to have to do a little bit of work to pull them out of the well before I start assembling them, and that's another that's way of thinking it. Or you can just do the sum, and we can do the sum, and it's just as easy as the last sum.
Schematic equation?
Oh no, this isn't exact, this is approximately true. And it, thank you, it's true for C bigger than C star. Yes, thank you. Yeah, it is the full blown expression is messy, but it has these asymptotics for large tape. It has exponentially suppressed asymptotics for below the Einstein Debye model, you know, for low concentration. It picks up the exponential factor that you might expect. Actually, this is just epsilon trans. I mean, this is slightly disingenuous in the sense that C star tape downstairs carries some of these factors. So in fact, at high concentration, the exponent it goes over. It's indistinguishable from the surfactant case. It goes over to just the net end cap energy. But the concentration at which it does it is not zero. It doesn't climb from zero. It shifted a bit.
Presumably, these atoms also in normal, like my cells, you need to
assemble. Yeah, something must happen. Yes. So, in fact, on a logarithmic scale, probably, these curves always look S-like.
Although you'd expect that to occur when molecular weight is fairly low. And you're saying that this effect actually can occur in one of your
rather large pieces
with high molecular weight.
Yeah.
Related question. I guess I don't understand why you're associating the degree of fraction of beta sheet with M. I might have thought.
Oh, I'm not. I beg your pardon. Sorry. Yeah, that's a big confusion. I'm not associating the fraction beta sheet. There are two things to calculate. Sorry. One is M. I should have written that. There's another formula. Pardon me for the fraction of beta sheet, and that also has this S-shaped behavior. Pardon me. In fact, it's actually this is actually dominated by that, because the fraction of what you're doing, if you like, it's a bit. The calculation is a little bit like a Bose condensate. In the case, it pays particular attention to m equals one, and there's a discrete population sitting at m equals one, and then all the rest. So in fact, it turns out the average polymerization is highly related to the amount of beta sheet because it only kicks off one once you've got some sizable aggregates larger than one. Okay, let's move on and see what I said. I'm going to say next. But that, as we've already thought about, is not the end of the story. Remember that hydrophobic side and hydrophilic side to the tape. There's no reason why they can't go on forming. So in particular, once you've got relatively long tapes with the slightly hydrophobic sides, the two hydrophobic sides are likely to want to aggregate, forming a double tape. There's another little energy parameter for that, epsilon ribbon per monomer, okay, which indicates the hydrophobic interaction. It need only be slight to engender this. These will be... note that these ribbons will still be twisted because they'll still be chiral, but there's no room for permanent Gaussian curvature anymore. So they will tend to be straight and twisted rather than bendy and twisted, which is the generic form for these guys.
Mean curvature.
Did I say Gaussian? Mean curvature. These really should, by symmetry, should not have a mean curvature, but they can still have a chirality. Why stop there? I described these outer surfaces as hydrophilic, but there's nothing quite so hydrophilic as water, and there'll typically be a small attractive interaction between even the hydrophilic sides. Be smaller than interaction between the hydrophobic sides, to be sure, but it'll be non-zero. Call that e-fibril, and you might expect even the ribbons, when they're long enough, to start stacking. So can you imagine a stack of these things? Looking down the axis, you'd see something like this. If there were four stacked ribbons twisted around, the compulsory TEM micrographs running up top. Okay, so this is at low concentration. This is all P P11.2, low concentration. By low, I mean about, what do you want the units? Millimolar, migs per mil, or volume percent? We've had all three so far. What's wrong with volume percent? Physicists look at this, say, I can't stand these biological units. Okay, I agree. Okay, yes, migs per mil, that's a good answer. 10 to the minus 3 migs per mil here. 10 to the sort of minus 1, 2 migs per mil, this guy. Pushing 1 mig per mil in the system we get here. Here they are, look, lovely, lovely stiff fibrils. And then even the fibrils themselves can superassemble. Suppose, for example, the edges of the peptide have a little self-attraction to one another, the ends of the rods. Once you've got two fibrils, the rod ends will come together and they'll stack into massive fibers. This is the twisting interaction. So here are two fibrils twisting together to form, let's call it a fiber.
What do you do actually? Do you really start from a solution and very dilute and just add a little bit to equilibrate? It's not all, you just start, just put a highly concentrated...
We've done both and we've come backwards as well.
So you get the same result?
Not always. In when the kinetics are fast enough, you get the you can get the same result both ways.
Yeah, because in this, but you actually say that there is fast kinetics for growing.
Yeah.
And fast kinetics slower.
Well, actually, it can even be slow to grow, but it's typically slower to decompose. So we have done an experiment where fibrils have been diluted down to the happy ribbon concentration, and after 6 months, there were loads of ribbons, but there were still some fibrils trying to fray apart. It's because they can't, they're not going to want to dissemble and reassemble. They can only do it by unzipping from an end, typically. And just imagine, you know, then these things get to be microns, even millimeters long. In fact, I'll show you a system where we believe the equilibrium length of a fibril is about the size of the radius of Pluto's orbit.
Can you explain again how you go from ribbon to fibril?
Yes. The idea is just to stack. So, Alexa, just put your hands on mine. And like that. Don't get two for a minute, like that, you see. And then another one, and another one. And then they'll be twisted. Okay, that's how it works. Okay?
Twisted lamella stacks.
Twisted lamella stacks, that's right, yes. Okay.
Since you've gotten rid of the main curvature, the twist is driven by...
chirality.
Okay. Something that's going to compete against your, I mean, your argument that the symmetry is going to always give you a twisted ribbon, that only tells you that it's not going to choose a particular side then for it. There is an effect which will disfavor the twisted ribbon, which is the fact that if you stack these things, you're fraying the
next slide.
Edges.
Okay. Next slide. Absolutely. Okay. That's why they don't stack forever.
No, I'm not talking about stacking. I'm talking about even the single ribbon before you start stacking.
Oh, fraying.
No, I just mean that as you stack these peptides next to each other.
Yes.
There isn't along each peptide is not a constant packing density in the local plane.
Yes. Okay.
And if you could imagine doing this with, now maybe it's just a question of how small your system is, but there will, I would expect, be an effect that would favor a cylindrical curvature, mean curvature, where it would wrap around in a helical fashion, still satisfying the chiral tendency, but it would basically be a spontaneous effect.
Oh, even in the ribbon?
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
Because the symmetry argument doesn't work for certain surfactants.
No, but they still choose to break the symmetry. Okay, yes. Okay, obviously...
Because of another...
Yeah.
And
the symmetry arguments, obviously, the wheels come off the carriage when the symmetry chooses to be broken.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good point. Good point. Okay, let's just press on. Well, what I want to say here, Carlos.
Where are we in the little diagram you showed us of the fraction of an assembled material?
Yes.
Before? So you have a nest-shaped curve like that.
Okay.
Which of these things happen where?
Okay, in fact, they happen sequentially. The first one I told you was just one of these things happening. When there's a sequence of them, close to the bottom, is that C star? So C star, C star was just close to the bottom of the curve, was the concentration in that case at which the free energy predisposed to the random little helices to straighten up and aggregate in the first place. That's just simply, that was the simple S-shaped, 1S is the self-assembly curve for the tapes, period, with no higher order aggregates. When you have higher order aggregates, you have at higher and higher concentrations, because the energies are lower and lower, the attractive energies are lower and lower, therefore the you need higher and higher concentrations to turn on these higher aggregates to keep the entropy of translation there.
So the first curve you showed us was just...
just a tape, just assembly into a tape. The first difference from ordinary surfactants, which is probably there in ordinary surfactants anyway, but low to concentrations. Going from tapes to ribbons, actually we've already seen the generic structure. You have an energy minimum in which your raw material lies. Now our raw material, remember, in the first case our raw material were just individual little peptides. Now the raw material to make ribbons are tapes. And they're happy, they're sitting in a free energy well. But when the concentration is high enough, it'll overcome that well and they'll self-assemble into ribbons. So for example, let's look at the expressions for the mean molecular weight or mean polymerization extent of the ribbons. Will also have the same structure with concentration. It'll turn on at a critical sort of concentration for ribbons, which is a tape critical concentration plus a bit, which has to do with getting them out of the tape well. Okay. All in the references. Okay, so that's forming this guy with a small energy parameter epsilon ribbon from the tapes.
Can you repeat that last thing about what controls the energetics, that additional little piece?
Yes, the additional little piece is the energy of association into tapes. So the happier it is being a tape, the higher the concentration you have to create to predispose it to form a ribbon.
And I can visualize that as having less hydrophilic things happily sequestered inside, the happier
yes.
it is to be there.
The happier it is to be there is to then make ensembles of large numbers of these objects. Okay? Because each time you take two of these tapes and stick them together and make a ribbon, you lose the entropy of translation of one of them. Mm-hmm. Low though this is, of course it is a polymer, but low though this is. Great. And they'll get stiffer. Yes, you lose internal entropy. So in fact, these epsilons are not. You're not going to calculate these epsilons just by adding up pair potentials. These epsilons have, and they will not be independent of temperature. They'll have an entropic piece to do with losing internal degrees of freedom as well. That's true.
May I ask another question?
Of course.
I'm still puzzled by the difference between the usual surfactant systems. And the difference I can see is that if I think about a worm like myself, I can think about any surfactant coming in and out of the micelle.
Yes.
Every time.
Yeah.
And so the probability of cutting and so on. In here, I think you are more thinking about a system which is irreversible in a sense. Isn't it? They assemble and that's it.
No, I better not. These calculations are statistical mechanics and they assume ergodicity.
Well, that was my next question.
When that leads on to time scale, of course. The time scales for these things can be long, but I think with these smaller peptides, there's no reason why this individual equilibration shouldn't happen. The small ones have about 5 or 6 hydrogen bonds. Okay? 5 or 6 kT, yeah, it's a tough bond, but it's not an unassailable rampart. I think there's a factor.
Go down to the question, are these living ribbons? Or
these are living ribbons. I believe these are living ribbons. But again, some of the higher order objects will not be living on a morning in the lab timescales. The fibrils, the fibers, the high-order aggregates have day, week, month-long kinetics.
The lower-order liquids are Maxwellian, or...?
Yes. Okay. Nearly. We'll see. Come to that in 10 minutes' time. Okay, so remember P11-1. No, you don't remember P11-1. P11-1 was the little aqueous peptide that didn't have any sticky things on the side that I missed. I copied and didn't change, didn't edit. Okay, so it in other words, it doesn't. It didn't have sticky hydrophobic things on one side. The reason for making one that did and one that didn't, you will now have guessed. We wanted a pair of peptides, one which would love forming the ribbons quickly. That's the ones with the aromatic rings on one side, and one that didn't particularly. This is the one that didn't particularly. This is the self-assembly curve. Okay, actually, you know, there's a dot. There aren't very many points here, but the single tape curve does a reasonable job of fitting the data. And of course, let me see these energy parameters. We have a single set of parameters will give us predictions for both the mean length of the tapes and the degree of aggregation. And different models will have different relations between the two. So this is the prediction for the amount of ribbons and the average molecular weight of ribbons and single tapes. We can choose between them. We can use rheology. I'll come on to that later. We're not much in that case, but we can also just look at the size of aggregates, also use dynamic light scattering and other scattering techniques. The single tape picture rather seems to do a reasonable job of P11.1. It does not do a good job at all of P11.2. The P11.2 self-assembly curve let's just look at the spectra, for example. The ultraviolet dichroism spectrum in P11.1 has a thing called an isochroic point. There's a point in the spectrum about which the peaks hinge. Okay. People say about that is that indicates that as a function of the solvent property, solution, or concentration of peptide in this case, we're just titrating between two different species. So you have more of one or more of another, which will be the dilute peptides, monomeric peptides in the tape. That property is lost in P11.2. There's no isochoric point. And what people usually say about that is indicates more than two species. So you have three populations vying with each other, and there's no particular point of the absorbent spectrum about which the absorbent should pivot. So the other piece of evidence that these are indeed forming the ribbons is that if we suppose that they don't, if we suppose that they form just the tapes, we can measure the self-assembly curve, the amount of beta sheet. We can cook up the parameters of the model, epsilon tape, we need for that model, to do as good a job as we can of the self-assembly curve. Then we've run out of free parameters, and we can ask it how long the tape should be at a particular concentration. And the answer is there are only a few monomers long in the case for the choice of parameters that successfully models the self-assembly curve. And there is no way that this material forms ribbons only a few monomers long. Remember, this is a 200 nanometer bar. Take the TM, for example. We've also got examples from other methods which indicate that these things are much longer. So this is the model that has single tapes and ribbons that takes... Oh, here, we even got the energy parameters here. So see if you think these are reasonable. It's a 3 kT to go from the 11 mer in solution doing its random thing to a straight rod. Three modes? Okay. To stick these things onto the end of a tape is a nice big energy because it's made of loads of hydrogen bonds. Okay, 25 kT. The ribbon energy is much more subtle. Per monomer, it's only half a kT. But that's in the right ballpark given we have these three aromatic rings. Now we have a very well modeled beta sheet density curve, and the predicted mean length of the fibrils with concentrations is much, much, much higher. Single tapes are right down here. This is in nanometers, so just a few nanometers we would get from single tapes. Now, once we're above 0.1 millimolar, there's this very, very large growth to 1,000 nanometers or more. And then you'll see what happens if we have fibrils coming in there. We get yet another one of these C-star events, each order of the hierarchy. Because the higher order the structure, the vastly longer they tend to be. because, you know, breaking a great big fibril apart, you're tearing away hundreds and perhaps hydrogen bonds, and you get to covalent bond strengths rather rapidly in the fibril here. So 10 to the 23 nanometers, what were those? Okay. Yeah, Victor, thank you.
You said that there are 5 or 6 hydrogen bonds in the
hole? Actually, that was wrong, wasn't it? There's a hydrogen bond per residue, so it's more like 10 hydrogen bonds.
Is that basically means 25 kT?
That's back to Carlos's question. So, well, what time? Calculate what time scale? It's not covalent yet. What's a picosecond multiplied by e to the 25?
About a millisecond.
Not locked in.
But the degree of hydrophobicity at the two sides of the tape, you're saying, actually, is very small. There's only a weak difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has anything been done to make it more so? Just to check.
Have we done more than that? I don't know. We now have a family of about 10 of these beasts. These are the three we've looked at most intensively. Some of those others will be more hydrophobic, but I don't know the detailed answer to that question.
So it's very small. You've either been somebody's been very clever or very lucky in getting hierarchical self-assembly. Once you form one structure,
yes.
If the second attraction is too strong, you never form
yes.
the
structure. Yes. Right. Yes. You follow the space away. So you can play very nice games with the energy, with changing the energy scales and the separation of energy scales. Now, I would suggest to you there is a canonical order. I think what we're looking at here is a rather generic order for these energy scales. It is much more likely. And the hydrogen bonds are the beefy guys, okay? The hydrophobic interactions are much weaker, and you can build, you know, we could reduce it or increase it by the number of hydrophobic side groups on the residues that were built in. It's likely that the face-face attraction of ribbons, just because they are faces, is going to be quite a bit stronger, perhaps an order of magnitude or two, than the end-end. But on the other hand, think of this one. Suppose you designed the peptide with end residues that were either electrostatically or otherwise predisposed to love each other in pairs. Then before you achieved the fibril structure, you might take ribbons and make a little box out of them. This is going a little bit ahead of time, but for those of you who know the parallel research programs to this going on in some of the more biological world to do with amyloid fibril formation from full-blown proteins, you may know that Chris Dobson's claim now in Cambridge is that by mucking about with temperature and solvent and kinetic environment, you can predispose any predispose any protein to form amyloid beta sheet fibrils, even those with no beta sheet structure in their native state at all. And one of those, yeah, they have a lovely, lovely micrograph of one which is very clearly a conduit, a square cross-section conduit of 4 beta sheets, which clearly are attracted by their edges rather than their faces. And my claim is that would fall into this model if we switch the order away from the generic order of epsilon fibril and epsilon ribbon. So I think it's semi-lucky. At first, actually, we thought we'd been very, very, very clever at making a designed peptide. These don't occur in nature. But in fact, Chris Dobson says you can get anything to do this, any bit of any protein from anybody. Oh, did I just tell you the persistence length of this thing is the center? Of course, the other thing is the persistence length is a strong function of the degree of hierarchy. The higher you go, the stronger the persistence length tends to be. I'm going to now tell you in 5 minutes 10 different ways of determining persistence length. You could trust the microscopy and smile and pray and hope and, you know, or you could do light scattering, or you could do small angle X-ray neutron scattering, or you can do nonlinear rheology and hope that you've got a good elastic model, or you can do, what's the other one? You can do VH, depolarized light scattering, and that's quite good at detecting if you've got rod-like pieces in there. Or you can do neutron scattering. And we've done all of those.
So you have clean, small angle neutron X-ray data where you can see single signatures of single filaments?
Yes. Relatively clean. Okay, but okay. So what stabilizes the fibrils? Because, look, one-dimensional self-assembly is not a phase transition, right? Two-dimensional self-assembly is what's normally called crystallization. Okay. So if you have attractive bonds which are enough to overcome translational entropy of the solvent in not one dimension but two, things tend to drop out of solution. That's what they should do. They shouldn't stay in solution.
These are the members, but it's a first-order transition. Without a sponge phase. Doesn't drop out of solution.
Oh, no, but it's okay.
It's a
but it's okay, it then forms a... Right. Well, okay. But in this... So this is the question of what stabilizes the fibrils in this case. So here, this is Sasha and Irina's work, is the twist stack model. They observed that. Remember, these ribbons have a happy sort of period of twist. Okay. Now, if you stack twisted objects that... have a happy bend, perhaps the bend is zero, or in a happy twist, they can't, it's not possible for every member in the stack to have the same bend and twist. Okay, it gets harder and harder. I mean, suppose you didn't change the period, and the ones in the middle of the stack were just twisting around like this, then the ones on the out of the stack are going to be twisting, but they're also going to be bending around like this in huge, great loops. Okay, so they have to pay bending energy. On the other hand, you can say, well, we don't want to do that, so let's untwist the stack, but then the guys in the middle didn't want to have a longer pitch, they wanted to have a nice short pitch. So, okay. So as you stack, you have to pay energy, internal energy. So more parameters, I'm afraid, but... So there's a bending energy, so nu is the vector along the chain, and theta is some... twisting angle. We've had all this. I would say ad nauseam because we couldn't possibly have too much of this stuff, could we? From stiff tapes earlier on. But there's a bending modulus and a twisting modulus, both of which will be compromised by self-assembly. And you can calculate what theta and nu are if you know the rho dimensions of the tape. And gamma, which is something. I thought you were going to ask that. I'll take those questions afterwards. Can't remember what gamma is at the moment. Gamma is the... gamma is has dimensions of... it's 1 over length. So... Rho is the thickness of the bundle, and gamma. Yes. That's what that. Yeah, I think that's how many tapes there are. It's a yes. I mean, you need some sort of width type parameter for your tapes. I'll dig this out later. But where all these things appear is in the energy is in the fibril energy. So there's a piece, remember, which so the number of tapes in the fibril, p. Each one gains so each interface, which are there p to the minus one interfaces between tapes, between ribbons in the fibril. Each one gives you a little bit of attractive energy, but you pay this. Elasticity, which you can minimize over twist and bend. And you get a structural phase diagram in terms of a free, this is the free energy of attracting another ribbon onto your stack. And this is the twist elasticity of the ribbon described as a pitch length normalized to the to the distance between ribbons in the stack. So a long twist period means weak twist elasticity. It's easy to untwist. So it's much easier in terms of attractive energy to get into infinite stacks and fall out of solution and kill all the twist completely. Obviously, you can always do this, and if the attractive energy is large enough to pay for all the untwisting energy per monomer, then you can do this. You can just form infinite stacks. in the opposite limit of very chiral twisted stuff, it's very, very hard to get into this infinitely second dimensional assembled state. In fact, it's rather easy to stay in ribbons. It's clear that the elastic untwisting energy can dominate everything. But here's this interesting space where there is a nice equilibrium number of ribbons in a stack. And here are the ISO stacks on this diagram for 3, 5, 10, 50, 250 ribbons. And so finite stacks can be achieved anywhere in this area, which is the sort of area that the non-extreme, middle ground, liberal democracy area in which most of these creatures are likely to live.
This is done in a sort of living polymerization limit. So again, assuming you have enough time to make transition
between. That's absolutely all this is true. Carlos.
Right, so that's not for an infinitely long.
No, it's not. It's for ribbon of the equilibrium size. Yeah, and the distribution. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. But in fact, by that stage, this energy balance is local. Pretty much, I think. I think the finite size may be put over the effects. You have polydispersed ribbons. You have to play end effects, and they are there.
So yes. You don't have distributions with filaments the size of Jupiter's orbit.
No, not for real. Not really. Those are the big guys. Okay, so we've said this a million times before, but here's a concentration of peptide. What tends to happen, of course, is that you start with single tapes, and then when single tapes, this is something I haven't said yet, but it's rather interesting. By the time you predispose ribbons, that acts as a chemical potential sink for or control for your single tapes, that the concentration of single tapes saturates and you build ribbons. When you get to C star fibril, you stop building ribbons anymore. You stick at a fixed concentration of ribbons and you start building fibrils. And that's how this self-assembly works. And you can, of course, eventually get stiff enough and you observe a pneumatic phase. And this is the fibril, the P11-2 fibrils under cross polars at 0.1 mg per mil. I better press on, actually. For those of you who are new, we typically don't mind if the talks go on till about 11:45, hour and a half, and then typically people can wander out and ask, or discuss till about 12, and then we all get too hungry. So this is a story. I'm trying to put everything together for you for P11-2. This is a story. Here's concentration in millimolar. Haha. Right, so 10 millimolar all the way there. Here's 1, here's 0.1. So we think we have monomers here. Then the rapid transition to the ribbons doesn't hang around as tapes very much. That tends to be rather disguised in this case, David. So David's point carries over P11-2. There's not really a big ribbon domain. Tape domain, rather. Soon forms ribbons. About 0.1 millimolar, you start getting these rigid, much more rigid fibrils. There's a little bit of pneumatic coexistence. And fibers, and then gel-like things with interesting rheological properties, twisted fibrils and fibers. Okay, a parameter summary. So you don't want to absorb all this data. Let's just go for one number. So this is our parameter set for P11-1 and P11-2. P11-2 had the sticky ones on the side. If we just look at the ribbon energy, for P11-2, you've seen this before, 0.6 of a kT to form ribbons. This guy, you can eventually see ribbons at very high concentrations, and that transmits itself to a very low coefficient, down by about 3 orders of magnitude. So you know, all these numbers are making sense. For those of you who want to study this table in depth, I can give you the references afterwards. So let's just look at dynamics and rheology. You could look at that, for example. Why is this useful? Well, rheology is very useful because these large polymeric aggregates give viscoelasticity. I'm just going to look at K24. This is work with PhD student Peter Moore from the SUMS Centre at Leeds, who has exhaustively studied just the K24 in two solvents, once methanol, once 2-chloroethanol. You remember I said methanol rather destabilized the fibrils. It just pushes it off to higher concentration. I won't talk about methanol because there's no time, but I'm happy to discuss that with people later. Rheology sees a very Okay, now, there are some mysteries. From now on, I've given you the completely false impression that everything is clear and well understood till now, roughly, okay? From now on, it will be even more obvious to you that they are not. Okay, so here come the puzzles. There is a much more rapid rheological transition than you might imagine between a mildly viscoelastic solution in and a viscoelastic solid. So now I've converted all these numbers to volume concentrations in the best way I know. So this is 10 to the minus 3, this is 4 times 10 to the minus 3, and we have checked this over and over and over again. It's titrated forwards, backwards, this is reproducible. So this is rheology, this is G primed and G prime, G double primed. This is essentially a fluid. This is a Bolin fluids rheometer, and it can't detect that there's anything in here that's not the solvent. This is the signal we get for G prime that we throw away. And actually, it is of the order of the inertial response. If you calculate what the inertial response from the bob will be, it'll give you something of this with the other signs. I don't know what's going on.
It's actually not the inertial response of the bob. It's just the inertial response of the liquid layer in between the radiant
spent
level to the detecting side.
Okay. Right. But of one side or other. But anyway, we throw this away because it's always there. This was the picture, you remember. This is just a concentration at which you saw those tapes very clearly in the micrograph, and the referees in Nature didn't, but you did. Then you, 4 times as much, you've got this. It's got a modulus of a pascal, about 3 or 4 pascals, actually. Okay, it's not. You're not going to drive a car on this stuff. You can make tires out of it, but it's a measurable modulus. It's got a clear plateau modulus. There's a nice minimum. There's a suggestive peak here that we never quite get to, Suzanne. So Suzanne Fielding will say straight away this is obviously aging material, and whenever you get a material that you can't, you can never quite see this crossover, it's just because the timescale of the measurement is dominating the rheology you see. It's just darn wrong, and we just cannot experimentally go with this equipment 0 to the minus 4, but it doesn't change with hanging around. You can't see those, Fred? What's wrong with your eyes? Come on. That's a frequency in hertz of 10 to the minus 4. Okay. So look, this looks Doy Edwards-like, basically, right? And even that is about a frequency to the minus a half. So what's going on, guys? Oh, well, let's just do the easiest thing. Let's just say, let's just calculate the plateau modulus with concentration. So here's the here's concentration mg per mil from 1 mg per mil to 100 mg per mil. And this is the plateau modulus, as far as we can measure it. And there it goes. Well, there's a rough, you could either say that there was a rough exponent of sort of 2-ish, or you could decide that this was a very clear crossover from 3 to 1.2. In which case, we'd be crossing over from the famous Morse loosely entangled regime, which goes as rho cubed, but no one believes that anyway, to the much more robust Morse tightly entangled regime, Morse mags, everybody, okay? Ronnie, rho to the goodness knows what this crazy exponent is. It's that, actually. Okay, why else might we? So you can do calculations. The scattering and other techniques in the microscopy suggest entanglements of 100 nanometers. So let's actually calculate what the curvature should be. If that's also the overlap. So if you just calculate, if you put LE equal to overlap concentration on the back of an envelope, you calculate 4 pascals for the modulus using a tightly entangled that. Okay, so that seems roughly right. The tightly entangled expression is, of course, completely useless for estimating the persistence length because it's got such a weak dependence on it. But as you're near a crossover anyway between loosely and tightly entangled, you might as well use the loosely one. That gives a plateau modulus of 500 nanometers, a persistence length of 500 nanometers, which is much more consistent with what you'd expect these things to be, and also with what the microscopy sees. So that seems reasonable. So the picture is these are marginally stiff polymers at this ribbon level. Additional evidence for that comes from the Doy Edwards-like spectrum. See events at the entanglement fest in the next phase. But for those of you who aren't aware, the prediction of G double primed with frequency in a Doy Edwards model is that right of the peak, the higher reptation modes give you omega to the minus a half. Worm-like micelles give you omega to the minus one in the pure Maxwell limit, and those are these. But any decent, any ordinary, even however monodisperse entangled polymer gives you roughly omega to the minus a quarter. Alexei will later on be telling us exactly why that is. But it has to do with longitudinal fluctuation modes cutting themselves, leading to constraint release. So additional stiffness is a we've proposed that some that I don't think David quite did, but a calculation that we might like to toy together over is how stiff you can make a stiff polymer in this intermediate zone before its internal stiffness suppresses all the contour length fluctuations that are responsible for this form, departure from Doy-Edwards in ordinary flexible polymers. So we've played with a crude model which just introduces a bending, what you call the bulk modulus, one-dimensional elastic modulus for contour length suppression, crossing over to the entropy one, to get a family of Doy-Edwards results plus contour length fluctuation. And this is another crude handle on the persistence length. And this tells us... This is the imaginary part of the dissipative modulus. And that's the Doy-Edwards result for reptating chains which are not doing this. Okay? So if you allow them to do this in the generic flexible chain case, you get this curve up here. Is much weaker exponent, and as you tune from one to the other by increasing the persistence length in a very, very crude model, you could get some sort of handle of what the persistence length is.
The relevant physics is constraint release rather than longitudinal.
Yes, it's not longitudinal modes, it's constraint release of the curvature contribution from the ends suffering these longitudinal releases. It's a bit different from... All the longitudinal modes have gone a long time ago. Time to stop. Nearly there. You can get a little bit more from this rheology, from Moore, Smags, and Moore, and everybody, because you have predictions for... So these are the McIntosh, Mags, Morse, and other M's longitudinal modes. That's when they finish, when your longitudinal extra length has diffused along a whole length. Then you have a sort of terminal regime, but then you pick up again because you're seeing the high-frequency end of the reptative contributions. So you can calculate, just knowing the frequency range between the reptation time, rotation frequency, and this minimum frequency, can give you an estimate of the length of the polymer. Actually. So we've used the rheology to extract both the persistence length, this is pushing rheology to its ultimate limit, to both the persistence length and the whole contour length independently. And we get values of about 100 microns, which is reasonable.
The two regimes that are viscous-like, with slope 1, will both be sensitive to that length.
Yes, they will. Yes.
Both the same length fits?
Oh, gosh. In the interest of getting everyone away to lunch, I must check that. Okay. This does seem to make some sort of sense. Yeah, did you see? Well, actually, no, we just have this. So we can't actually see... No, maybe this answers your question. We can't actually see the end of this regime, not in our rheometer, but we can see the bottom of its terminal effect.
You have some sense of where the rotation peak has to be for the intermediate regime to work.
Yes.
I guess it must be in some sense that one-half is also sensitive to the overall length of the chain.
Yeah, well, look, we only have one number here, so we're going to get one ratio.
Okay.
So we have one number, and so we can get one ratio out of this, which is L, which is, say, L to LE.
Well, you treat your friction coefficient as entirely adjustable.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. But if we didn't, yes, we do. Okay. Depolarized light scattering. So I just want to tell you about light scattering, which we went to Crete and did this with the experts, and Dimitri Vlasopoulos will be here later on. So VH scattering, no time for this, but is another way of looking at, of getting at the persistence length, and that 500 nanometers comes out very nicely, again, from that. The dynamic light scattering is more or less single mode, and it's more or less diffusive across almost the entire range of concentration. There is a slow type gel mode, but this is the way of saying this is that the Q-dependent diffusion, cooperative diffusion constant, isn't Q-dependent, it's flat. So there's a dominant mode in diamond light scattering, and it's diffusive, which looks like concentration fluctuations. With the dynamic light scattering technique, we can get signals from the polymers at enormously low concentrations, at all the way down to 10 to the minus 7 millimolar. It's a very, very sensitive technique. What I've got here is the effective relaxation rate of the mode Q with concentration. Dilute, semi-dilute, independent of concentration until the chains start overlapping into your light scattering window. Then it falls down when you start seeing cooperative modes of the melt. But this exponent ain't fast enough for anybody. Even if these were really stiff, this should be minus a half, I think. This is a rather weak concentration limit for that. I'm just throwing up anomalies. Second anomaly is that in this crucial region where we saw the transition in the rheology, remember the whole thing seemed to flick rheologically from something we couldn't see to something which looked like a whole entangled polymer within a factor of four. There is this huge hike. And I think that what may be happening is a fibril formation, or something like a fibril formation, which slows everybody down in a particular concentration regime. But
your logic is that you multiply by Q to the minus 2. Do you mean that it's going like U square, or is it rising from... Where are you in the...
So this is... Okay. So this would be gamma of Q, I said, went diffusively almost everywhere until we got to the rheologically very high concentrations, and that's what this flat piece is here. So gamma Q will go like Q squared.
All over this?
Well, no, all over here. Here's how I plotted gamma Q divided by Q squared, all right?
You're fitting gamma Q to a simple exponential?
Yes. The signal is fitted to a single exponential in time, which is a very good fit.
That works.
That works. It's almost single mode. Okay. I can show you the... Yeah. That I'll show you. Come to you later. Well, those are that's the correlation function data. I think we should stop. The thing I want to say to finish while Tony's looking at our raw data is that these structures do resemble amyloids. Here's a medical, or it's biological amyloid fibril. It's a twisted beta sheet structure. These are what happens in your brains when you have Alzheimer's disease. And remember, this is the one we made with DN. With peptide 2.
Similar width,
yeah. And okay, so here are some conclusions. I do have some rough models for the kinetics, which look a little bit like some stuff that Carlos has written down for fibers self-assembling on surfaces, so we need to talk. We may have a cleanish model system for the rheology. And in that sense, physics may have a lot more to say about things like biology when biology goes badly wrong. And it's something generic to say here. If you say anything about proteins, proteins are so specifically designed, it's kind of hard to get physics in there. But if something goes wrong with the physics, with the proteins, and they start doing things that they weren't biologically designed to do, like self-assemble rather than fold, then, of course, the morass of statistical mechanics is all you've got. You fall off the top of Mount Probable and you end up in the swamp of statistical mechanics. So I'd recommend that if you're interested in doing biological physics, poking around pathology might be more productive than trying to understand these beautiful, you know. Anyway, there we are. Thanks very much. End. Okay, so this one.
If they are very flexible, I would think you'd go over to Zim regime.
That's correct. That's right. We don't see Zim behavior in the dynamic light scattering.
That's surprising.
It is surprising. We also see, I have to say, the other thing I didn't think I actually said.
The triangle length and two diameter just as they're all comparable, so you don't get clean.
Well, rather than T to the 1/4 or T to the 1/2, T you see more exponential.
Well, actually, I mean, I'm not sure this is.
Do you get a low Q where you have a single, a small Q when you have a single exponential relaxation? A diffusive, I think, is in the regime of
when the block. Several things you should not be saying.
You just see diffusion of the mass,
but that's not what you should be saying.
If you're looking inside a single chain, you should not be seeing a simple diffusive.
So what is the Q? What is the Q that you are measuring?
Light scattering Q, right?
Okay, that's scattering at
500 nanometers.
What is it?
Well, where do you want me to answer that question? Well, it's changing.
Somewhere.
Entanglement length is, well, it's zero, essentially. Well, it's, it looks as though, look, actually, one thing I want to have to say is that at no point. Okay, if you look at the Q dependence of the light scattering, even right out here when we're looking at a single chain signal, at no point is there any indication that we see a radius of gyration. So if you make a Kratky plot, you never see a rollover, you never see the signal that you've seen the whole polymer size. So the dynamic light scattering is rather strange. It indicates, even at these super low concentrations, it indicates that the tape overall radius of duration of these tape-like polymers is still bigger than Q to the minus 1. Now that's strange. I think it's strange because if you suppose you fit your self-assembly kinetics all happily in the regime where you can measure it spectroscopically, you wouldn't expect, I've done this calculation, you wouldn't expect the length to be any more, the whole length, to be any more than 100 nanometers down here. But the light scattering says that it is. And that's assuming C star is still to the left of this. If C star is getting in the way, then it's even less. So there are huge problems with K24, which we have yet to resolve, at which only the dynamic light scattering seems to have shown up. So I would say the existence of really big polymers, apparently, right down at these low concentrations is one. Maybe kinetic, but Amalia went to Heraklion for 6 months to do this, and we knew by then we had to do a very careful job to keep measuring the system, let it relax, go back 2 weeks later, go back 2 months later, do it again. They do seem to be consistent. That's one problem. This strange slowing down of gamma, here's gamma Q squared, before it speeds up again. This is the usual cooperative speeding up, but there's this minimum, which may or may not be real. I think it's probably real, because I think something like that might be affecting this very rapid rheological transition. And we see this rather strange exponent.
You can't have gamma going like U squared if you say that the size of your polymer is much larger than the wavelength.
That's what we just were saying, yes, that's right.
No, you can't have the scaling of gamma going like U squared. Do you see gamma when you put gamma?
We see gamma going as Q squared down here.
This is completely unreasonable.
Yes, that's what we're saying.
No, I'm not talking about the exponent with time, I'm talking about the exponent.
That's right.
Q.
Exponent with Q is unreasonable.
Wouldn't that Q have given some effects with Q squared?
No, you have Q squared times T to the 3/4. So gamma of Q, if you fit into a special pattern, will be a higher Q, Q to the 4.
Wouldn't this be pointing to a living system?
Well,
it
might just be.
See, yeah. In the rheology, there are many features which you see in self-associating tensidic surfactant solutions. Hofmann's measure 20 years ago in Bayreuth.
Yeah.
I looked at the frequency dependence of these substances. There's very similar curves on the cheap brine, cheap brine.
Yes.
First glance, if I had known where it comes from, I would have said, well, that's one of these.
Well, that's right. They do look like self-assembled, except if you look very closely, the slope to the... that's right. And in fact...
they're on a single exponential behavior. And
that's right. Which is this. That's what this data is. So this is... This does seem to be an example of a self-assembled system... Well, what this says is the exchange time. You see, this does say the exchange time is much, much slower than in a surfactant system. Yeah, the very fact that this is not single exponential indicates for those of us in the self-assembled selector community that this is not in the limit of very rapid breaking time.
Is what you'd expect. The Alliance scattering, I guess the static and the dynamic imaging are very, very different populations. The static light scattering, you see the big things.
Yeah.
The dynamic light scattering, you see the things which go a long way, which is going to be typically small.
Yes.
So you're essentially, in one, you're looking at the average sine value of R, and the other, you're looking at the average value of 1 over R.
Right.
You've got a broad distribution.
R.
You can be looking at completely different objects at the same time.
R. No, that's a good point. That's a good point, because if you, well, actually it would be very interesting to do that convolved with a Floyd distribution and see what you'd expect to see. So are we so the fact that we're seeing what looks like simple diffusion in the dynamic light scattering may well be because we're looking at just the straightforward diffusion of your average 1 over R little object.
The exponential distribution, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine that an exponential distribution is broad enough to get different signals in those two.
But how good are the exponential fits? I mean, you have fairly limited Q range.
It's behind you.
Yeah. You've not often plotted on linear scale.
Yeah, but it's a fairly limited
Q
range.
You can't see very well.
Well, if you look at the contin, but what they have got there is the contin spectrum.
If you think an exponential in time, you always get Q squared. So
yeah, that's not enough to find the average, right?
Just might be the longer.
Right. Right. That could be. That could be it. Yes. Okay. Of course, if you take dynamic light scattering in its formal limit omega equals zero, you should just, of course, just recover the static light scattering. But
it's a time and it's an open loop, so you're in time in one case and frequency in the other, so you can't actually take one as the limit of the other.
Yeah.
Static is omega equals zero.
Yes.
It's not the same thing as t
going to zero, because t going to infinity, you don't have any signal. Yes. That's worth following up. We should stick some real numbers to that one. Okay. Any other points? Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.